May it please the court, David DeBold from Gibson Dunn for Paul Minor, and also speaking on behalf of all three defendants on the validity of their convictions for honest services fraud. I will also briefly address the sentencing issues at the tail end. We are asking this court to re-examine its earlier ruling under admittedly special circumstances. Given the Supreme Court's decision forbidding honest services fraud convictions for undisclosed conflicting interests or concealed self-dealing and the like, a decision that the Supreme Court grounded in the void for vagueness doctrine under the Fifth Amendment, the jury instructions here failed to draw the necessary distinction between, on the one hand, efforts to influence an elected official through undisclosed payments, and on the other hand, agreements to exchange payments for official acts. The jury instructions
okay,
here.
I was here the last time we did this, not physically here, but on the panel.
I understand.
I don't really like redoing work I've already done. Why isn't this issue foreclosed by the fact that Skilling came out while y'all were still before the U.S. Supreme Court and had y'all, on the first go-around,
right,
had y'all raised it with the Supreme Court, they could have done, sometimes they do this, they'll say everybody who's in the system will just vacate and send back so all the courts of appeals can consider, you know, this new precedent that we have. So the fact that that didn't happen, why didn't that kind of end the debate?
It doesn't end the debate for a couple of reasons. First of all, the government's position before the Supreme Court when we filed for certiorari on a narrower issue of a First Amendment split between the circuits on a narrower question, the government said that in the interest of judicial economy, the court should just deny the petition, let us go back to the district court because we were going there anyway for a resentencing, work our way back up to the Court of Appeals, and then, if necessary, back to the Supreme Court. We already were going back to this court so that this court could consider this issue, and in fact, so the district court consider the issue. The Supreme Court would not want to be in a position later on, after we argue this appeal,
be deciding. We're not talking about whether what the Supreme Court could take. I'm not going to get in the middle of what they could take. That's
right.
Up to them. I'm saying y'all are well aware of the fact that we had a limited remand. It wasn't remanding for the whole do-over. It was sentencing. Convictions were affirmed except for the one, you know, that's not before us, about the federal program bribery or whatever. We reversed that. Everything else was affirmed. Sent it back for resentencing because we reversed that. All right. Now you're in front of the Supreme Court on the whole thing, you know, convictions and everything like that. It seems like if you're thinking the world has changed, you know there's a mandate rule and all that. Don't you need the Supreme Court to say, yeah, the world's changed, or we think it should be vacated, I'm not even saying the Supreme Court has to take it substantively. They can vacate what we did and send it back to us and say, hey, look at Skilling, as they did in Skilling. They said, hey, look at Skilling in Skilling to our court, and we did.
But the government's position was that this is going back to the district court anyway.
Okay, the
question then becomes whether the law of the case doctrine prevents us from asking you to re-examine a decision.
Well, I'm not, I mean, it's, the government doesn't control our jurisdiction.
I understand.
Okay? And you're not bound by what they say. You're the defense attorney, so why wouldn't you say something? That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, in our petition, we asked the court to address a circuit conflict on a narrower question that dealt with a particular aspect of the challenge to the jury instructions, not the challenge as a whole that was based on Skilling. We could not, in a reply brief, ask them to take up a different issue. But regardless of that, the way that the case will get to the Supreme Court for them to resolve any questions we might have about the validity of the instructions, which the government said we have the right to do after we've gone back and come back up, is for the Supreme Court to have the considered judgment of the lower court, the district court, and of this court on the very issue that we are asking the court to look at. This court is in the best position to decide whether a reexamination of its earlier ruling is appropriate in light of Skilling. And if you say that it shouldn't be reexamined, then we will take that to the Supreme Court with the benefit of your advice and guidance to the court on that particular question. Our position on the merits is that the Supreme Court has limited the honest services fraud statute in a way that really nobody anticipated. None of the participants in the Supreme Court cases that led to the Skilling decision asked for the particular way in which the court narrowed it. It came from an amicus brief. And now that we are before this court, knowing that undisclosed conflicts of interests that may have some sort of an influence on an elected official is not within the scope of the statute. And if you look at the way the government argued this case, if you look at the way the jury was instructed, if you look at the closeness of the issues, given the verdict in the first trial and given the not proven determinations on two of the counts in this trial, there is a sufficient risk under harmless error review that the jury in this case convicted these defendants for something that is not a federal crime under the Skilling ruling.
It seems to me that the jury in this case convicted these people of bribery. Mm-hmm. And that was what this case was about.
It was bribery as defined under state law.
And yes, and it's also, I mean, I understand the government may not take this position, which I'm sort of appalled at, frankly, but we'll wait till he gets up. But I read the Supreme Court opinion as saying we're talking about a federal overarching statute, but there are places in the Supreme Court opinion that specifically refer to bribery and violation of state law. So I don't read the Skilling opinion as being limited to federal bribery problems. I see it as also encompassing state law bribery problems, which is exactly what happened here.
Well, Skilling articulated a national standard for bribery, which was informed by federal statutes, and they cited those statutes as the basis for the definition of bribery. The critical difference is that under the state law definition that the jury was instructed on, the jury could find...
Let me read you a sentence, two sentences. The Supreme Court asserted that overlap with other federal statutes does not render Section 1346 superfluous. The principal federal bribery statute, Section 201, for example, generally applies only to federal public officials. So 1346's application to state and local corruption and to private sector fraud reaches misconduct that might otherwise go unpublished.
Right.
I don't think...
The way I read that, Your Honor, is that they're saying we have a Section 201. It's the federal bribery statute applying to federal employees. Now that honest services fraud is limited to bribery and kickbacks, that limitation of who can be prosecuted is gone. You can prosecute a state official, you can prosecute a private individual, but you are prosecuting them based on the definition of bribery that comes from federal law. And if you look back at this court's Tomlin decision, which dealt with the analysis of a conviction that in turn had counts that were brought under the Section 201 statute. The court said that in that case, the instructions were permissible and were proper because the jury had been given in return for language under the 201 instructions.
You know, I mean, frankly, this just really sounds familiar. Y'all made the quid pro quo argument. We essentially accepted it, except we said you don't have to have it in those words. I mean, the Latin isn't what's needed. And we found in the last go-around that, in fact, the jury had found, just as Judge King said, that there was a bribe, if for no other reason than the way the convictions went. I mean, it wasn't like they convicted only minor and acquitted the other two, or they only convicted the judges and acquitted minor. They convicted everybody. They said everybody acted corruptly in this. So, I mean, there may be, you could find a hair here and there, but I frankly think you're under a plain error standard on this issue. And I'm having trouble seeing how we're really addressing something new.
What the jury convicted them of was an agreement, but what was the agreement? And the instructions allowed them to convict for an agreement to attempt to influence officials. If you look at the McCormick decision, if you look at how the jury instruction read in that case, it said that the payments were made to the official on behalf of doctors with the expectation that such payment would influence Mr. McCormick's official conduct and with the knowledge on his part that they were paid to him with the expectation by virtue of the office he held. The influence language is where we run into trouble. If the court had used three words in its instructions, either in exchange for or in return for, we would not be here. And it's important for the court to clarify that the law requires the jury to find something in exchange for something else.
Did you make that objection to
we
the
offered
jury
a jury
instruction?
We offered jury instruction number 18, which had that language multiple times, and the judge rejected it. There was a heated debate. I can't say heated, I was reading the transcript. But there was an extensive debate during the jury instruction conference on whether there should be a quid pro quo requirement. And Judge Wingate ultimately decided I'm going to give an instruction that doesn't require a quid pro quo because I don't believe it's required. He said, and this was the offering to bribe, he said there need not be a mutual intent between the offeree and the offeror, or between the offeror and the offeree, or the acceptor of the bribe. Now, he said the reason he was doing that is because there is no quid pro quo requirement under the state law at issue. And that is why this jury, there is an unacceptable risk that this jury...
Yeah, but the problem is that he's right in the sense that if as we were leaving the courthouse, you came up to me and said, here's $100, do the right thing. That would be a crime even if I went running away screaming, okay? Right. The fact is here we did have an acceptance. So in other words, we had the offer, here's the $100, actually,
but
quite
the jury,
a bit more.
The jury
did find there was an acceptance because they convicted the judges as well.
But they didn't have to find a mutual intent. That was the purpose of the instruction. If you look at what Judge Wingate said when he decided to give the instruction.
Okay. I think the offer and the acceptance are enough. In other words, if you're going to make the offer to pay me for a ruling and I accept that, that's both of us are guilty of bribe. You're the offeror, I'm the offeree, or we'll use X and Y because I don't really want to be part of this scheme, and neither do you, I'm sure. But the point is that the argument you all were making is there wasn't a present, like, tomorrow you're going to rule this way. It was an anticipation of a ruling, and that was the argument y'all made that was the problem, and I didn't buy that then, and I respectfully
don't buy it now. And we're not asking you to say they had to have in their mind what it was going to be. It's kind of like the major league trades where you have the player to be named later. It could be that kind of agreement.
And that was
but
the
it
deal
has
they
to
cut.
Be. That's not what the jury was asked
I think
about.
That's what the jury found.
If I could just briefly on the Tapia rehabilitation issue, point out that we are very strongly arguing that plain error review does not apply to that issue. The judge did not say that my client needed a sufficient amount of time in prison until the written judgment, which came quite a good deal after the oral statement of sentence. And we presented evidence that Mr. Minor had already gone through two in-custody rehabilitation programs, and we were hopeful that he would be able to successfully transition back into society. And the judge did order him to have alcohol treatment and alcohol testing while he was on supervised release. There was no reason for us to object until we saw the written judgment, which said that he really wanted him to get additional treatment in prison.
Did that result in a longer sentence?
Well, the judge said, you need a sufficient amount of time in prison in order to deal with this alcohol problem, when he was announcing his reasons for imposing sentence. So there's clearly enough reason to believe that the judge would not give him a lower sentence because he thought this was the minimum that I think you need in order to get proper treatment in prison.
No. Okay.
I think he actually got a lighter sentence because he did go through the rehab, but fair enough. We need to move on.
We have your argument. Mr. Crosby.
Good morning, Justices. I can really begin to appreciate the increase in my client's sentence in that only a matter of hours ago, an event took place on the interstate in which my life flashed before my eyes, and I can begin to appreciate just the importance of even a few months that in which a sentence would be increased.
We don't doubt that every month in jail is a long month.
Yes, ma'am. In this case, my client's sentence was increased. I'm talking specifically, and that's what I'm here to address is specifically.
Yeah. Can you just do the math for me very quickly? Yes, if ma'am. We went your way on this issue of the 18-level enhancement for the amount of harm or the intended loss or whatever, if we went your way on that, what difference would it make on the guidelines? I'm just trying to get the math in my head.
Well, there'd be a two-level decrease with
right, but what in terms of months, what would the guideline, how would that change?
That it goes between 8 to 15 months. I have the chart here. I'd have to go back because I wasn't really going to address that, and I pushed.
Oh, okay. If somebody else is going to talk about it, that's fine.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. That's fine. We'll hear from somebody else. I just want to get the math in my mind clearly.
Yes, ma'am. What I was going to refer to is that when a man's case is overturned by the appellate court, and he goes back for resentencing, and everything before the judge, the district court judge, indicates that this individual's behavior has been outstanding, his conduct is good, He has improved himself and abided by all terms and conditions of his incarceration. But then the judge increases the sentence, then there's a presumption of indictedness as set forth in the Pierce case and as set forth in the brief. In this case, he originally was sentenced to 110 months because it included the federal program's bribery case. When the court, when the appellate court removed that from consideration, he was left with all his remaining counts of 60 months running concurrent. Judge Wingate took the final count, 7 of that series of remaining counts, and increased it by 15 months. The courts have established this very clearly, that when there is no explanation as to why the sentence was increased, then there's a presumption of vindictiveness. With respect to addressing that issue, Judge Wingate was specifically asked, it was objected to when he increased the sentence, and he was specifically asked why did he do that? And he said, well, if it wasn't for the federal program's bribery, count 11, then my address of count 7 would have been different. So, your justices, I submit to you that he specifically identified that he was still punishing Judge Whitfield for the federal case clearly by that language. Your honors had indicated that the sentence was likely to come down with respect to the very language of your case. You indicated it was likely to come down, but it went in the opposite direction.
Okay, I think we have your argument. Thank you. Mr. Lucas?
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, Court, I'm George Lucas, appearing for Mr. Westhill today. I have very brief time for argument, but what I want to stress, as we have for the last 9 years, is that Mr. Teal is different from Mr. Whitfield. Throughout this entire case, they have compared the two alleged schemes and the way that Mr. Minor acted towards those two judges as though it was exactly the same. The money that came in Mr. Teal's direction was used entirely as a campaign contribution. If the court will recall from the record, Mr. Minor signed a loan guarantee to the campaign for $25,000. The campaign did not even draw all that money. No money went to Mr. Teal's personal benefit throughout the entire.
Okay, but isn't this just revisiting the conviction we already affirmed? And you don't have a sentence issue because he's out.
I do not have a sentence issue, Your Honor, and I appreciate you not asking me about the calculations because I have not made them. That is correct. But while we were revisiting this issue in the light of Skilling, I wanted to make sure that this court revisited Mr. Teal specifically separately.
Well, we may not be revisiting this in light of Skilling. You all are. But we're definitely, even if we adopt the defendant's view of Skilling, are definitely not going to go into this underlying thing about how it was a campaign contribution and all that whole story. We've been through that. I mean, that was hundreds of pages of briefing that I had the privilege of reading and memorizing 3 years ago. We're not doing that again. At least I'm not. Maybe my colleagues, they weren't there. They enjoy that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to stress that Mr. Teal's situation is different from Mr. Whitfield and Mr. Minor.
Fair enough.
And
we hear you.
Any questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That difference may be why he's out.
I'm sorry?
That difference may be why he's out and the others are still in.
Mr. Romano.
May it please the court. I represent the United States. The defendant's challenge to the jury instructions is not properly before this court, but even on the merits, it does not justify vacating the convictions. The main procedural obstacle is that the claim is waived. The defendants did not raise it in their first appeal in their briefs, and as Your Honor's questioning indicated, they did not raise the Skilling issue even after the decision came out. While the cert petition was still pending, they had not yet filed their reply brief in the Supreme Court.
Okay, so what is your take on the questioning I had? They seem to be saying that because somehow you invited the Supreme Court to wait or something, that means we should ignore the fact that Skilling came out while it was still there.
No, Your Honor, we don't agree with that argument by the defense. The Solicitor General, in his opposition to the cert petitions, did not in any way concede that On remand, the defendants were entitled to raise an issue that could have been raised at an earlier point. What we argued in the cert petition response was that the case was in an interlocutory posture because the defendants had not been resentenced yet, and therefore that the court, as a potential matter, the Supreme Court could deny review at this point so that in a future cert petition, the defendants could re-raise the claim they were raising at that point along with any issues that would have come out of the resentencing. We certainly were not suggesting that the defendants on remand could raise a new claim, a new challenge to the jury instructions.
My question was a little bit more pointed in the sense that I'm asking, couldn't they have, since they were still before the Supreme Court, I understand that the initial briefing had been completed, but they were still in front of the Supreme Court when Skilling came out.
That's correct.
Could they not have, as a matter of procedure, said, whoa, wait a minute, folks, this changes everything. Please at least vacate this so we can have the Court of Appeals consider our convictions, which are no longer current as far as the Court of Appeals is concerned. Reconsider our convictions in light of.
They certainly could have made that request.
Procedurally, that's doable.
I believe that would have been procedurally doable, and I believe it's very common for a litigant who has a pending cert petition to request the GVR that the Supreme Court grant grant the petition, vacate the judgment with instructions to reconsider in light of an intervening Supreme Court decision. But our argument actually even goes further, Your Honor, because even where the Supreme Court has remanded a case to this court for further consideration in light of an intervening Supreme Court authority, this court still applies the waiver doctrine. And it did so in the Taylor and the Ogle case. So we, our main argument here is that the fact that the defendants did not raise the issue of reliance on state law or alternative theory error in their briefs and their arguments to this court is what produced the waiver. We do believe
their objection, their proposed jury instructions cover this area. He said that they had the proposed jury instruction with three key words that would have.
I don't think so. You know, their main objection to the jury instructions was that the jury needed to find that at the time the things of value were provided by a minor, that there needed to be a specific identified official act that minor wanted in return for the guarantee on the People's Bank loans. That was the focus of the objections in the district court. So we submit that plain error review is at most is what the defendants are entitled to on their Skilling challenge to the jury instructions. And on the merits of the jury instructions, I know Judge King, you were questioning about our.
About that, I mean, I'm glad you're here from the Department of Justice. So it's the Justice Department's position that the Skilling case
supersedes the the line of cases beginning with Brumley, Your Honor, and we do so. That is the department's position. And we believe that is so because Skilling indicates that honest services law needs to be defined according to a, quote, uniform national standard, unquote, a standard that derives content in part from federal bribery and federal kickback statutes. So we read the language of Skilling and the court's decision in Skilling for courts to look at federal bribery law.
So if all they violated is the state bribery law, but they didn't violate a federal bribery law, then your answer would be that it's not covered.
Right, our answer would be different. Of course, very often there is overlap between what a state bribery statute prohibits and what a federal bribery statute prohibits, and I think that was what the court decided in the 2009 case, that here, while the district court did use the Mississippi bribery statute to define honest services bribery law, this court held that the instructions were perfectly consistent with federal bribery law. First, the court concluded that the instructions satisfied the requirements of the federal official bribery statute, section 201B. And the court went even further. It said even under the heightened explicit quid pro quo requirements of McCormick, assuming they applied, that the jury instructions satisfied that. And
see, that was my memory, is the whole thing was that there wasn't a present. It wasn't like my hypo of walking out of the courthouse and somebody tries to hand me money for a ruling I'm fixing to make in a case that's right there in front of me. Here, particularly with, I think it was it Teal who was running for the first time? He was running for the first time, so obviously there wasn't a particular case that at that moment he could do anything about. But it was like a, you know, draft pick to be named later, as he said. That was the deal. And in fact, Minor structured it so that Whitfield would be on the hook throughout because he had this constantly ballooning loan situation. So he constantly had him under his thumb waiting for the right moment. And I felt like that satisfied both statutes.
That's correct, Your Honor. And, and the court's conclusion, you know, if I can just quote it, it says, you know, in light of the language and the instructions, the jury's guilty verdict necessarily entailed the finding of an exchange of things of value for favorable ruling in the judge's courts. And what's even more important is the fact that the Skilling decision actually cites the Whitfield decision as an example of using federal statutes to define honest services fraud law. So we think this court's decision in 2009, coupled with Skilling's reliance on it, really are more than sufficient to show the absence of alternative theory error and the absence of prejudice from any state law error if this court were to indeed agree with the government's position.
As far as the sentences, which clearly are before us, before we forget those, can you help me on the math?
Certainly, Your Honor. And Your Honor's question was...
Well, what I was trying to figure out was, and I just may be misunderstanding the math, I thought that he got 75, he being Whitfield, got 75 months.
That's correct. At the
and which would be within the range if you took the 28 level and reduced it by two.
That's correct. It would still be within range.
But because the judge had downwardly varied, that's why they're claiming there. I'm just having trouble with the math and how it fits in here in terms analyzing harmless or harmful error.
Sure. I think the where the math really comes in is with respect to the challenge to the 18-level enhancement for the value of the benefit of the bribe. And that was based on...
Right, and I understand okay, we go down two levels, let's just say.
Right,
let's put aside your issue about the 2001-2006 guidelines. Right. Let's just spot them that for now. So we go down two levels, but... unless I'm looking at this wrong, that takes us to a 63 to 78. He's criminal history one, right?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct.
I'm glad to hear a judge was a criminal history one. All right. And so the 75 months is still within that.
It's still a within guideline range sentence, and I think the court could look at that fact and conclude that even if there were an error in the 18-level enhancement, the fact that he still gets a within guideline range sentence, coupled with the seriousness of his conduct and all the things the district court considered, the court, I think, the record would permit to conclude that any error in the guidelines computation as to Whitfield was harmless. And we would certainly make a harmless error argument as to the calculation of minors' guidelines range. The arguments are slightly different because there are different calculations involved.
What's your take on the vindictiveness point with Whitfield?
Your Honor, Mr. Whitfield received on remand a sentence that was 35 months shorter than his original sentence. He got 110 months the first time and 75 months the second time. Now, the fact that the particular sentence on count seven the second time around was more than it was the first time around did not trigger the presumption of vindictiveness under the rule in North Carolina versus Pierce. And that's because this court held in the Campbell case, I believe it was in 1997, that when considering, when courts are to consider whether a sentence on remand was harsher than the original sentence, courts are to compare the total original sentence with the total sentence on remand.
We don't look at the specific counts, like you said.
Exactly.
I increased the sentence in count seven because I couldn't do what I did on count 11. It doesn't matter. It's the total, the package that really matters.
Exactly, and I think the rule makes perfect sense because sentencing are fact-intensive inquiries. When you change one circumstance, I think it requires a sentencing court to reevaluate the factors it has before it and to come up with a new sentencing package. And Mr. Whitfield's attempts in his reply brief sort of get out from under the Campbell case are really not persuasive in our view. The conduct underlying the bribery count was some of the same conduct underlying the fraud counts. At the resentencing, Judge Wingate made clear that if he had not had the vacated robbery conviction available to him, that his sentence on count seven would have been different. And certainly there was nothing else in the district court's rationale at the resentencing that indicates any vindictiveness or unreasonableness. The district court really cut Mr. Whitfield a big break at resentencing. He gave him a credit for acceptance of responsibility for statements that Mr. Whitfield made during his allocution, and that's unusual because usually that credit is reserved for pretrial conduct. And another example would be that he doesn't fine Mr. Whitfield this time around, whereas he had fined him $125,000 the first time around. So really, we don't think there's any room to argue that the sentence on Mr. Whitfield was vindictive or that it was discriminatory, which is another claim that he's making, and we would urge the court to affirm it. I would like to backtrack, if I may, to address the Tapia issue that counsel for Mr. Minor addressed. The government does agree that Tapia error occurred, the resentencing occurred before the Tapia decision came out. While we stand by our argument that the claim should be reviewed for plain error, I think the court could resolve this, the Tapia issue, on the lack of prejudice in the record alone. So I think even if a harmless error standard were to be applied by this court, a minor sentence should not be vacated.
And I mean, it seemed to me the judge actually gave him credit for the fact that he had rehab. Mr. Minor had a very serious alcohol issue.
That's correct.
That had affected a great deal of his life, not just this part. And he went through rehab in prison, as I understand it. And my appreciation of what Judge Wingate was saying, at least at the sentencing, which frankly the oral controls are the written anyway, but that what he was saying at sentencing is, I'm acknowledging that. I'm sort of appreciating that in giving you the sentence I'm giving, not so much. I know that the sentence was awkward in the written statement, but to me, I don't think he's saying I'm lengthening your sentence. I think he's saying I'm acknowledging that your whole sentence at the time may have included that, but I'm acknowledging that you benefited from that.
That's correct. I would agree, Your Honor, and I would refer the court just specifically toward the end of his explanation for the sentence at pages 2394 and 95 of the record. Judge Wingate says, I could have imposed the same sentence as I did the first time around, and I would have were it not for your post-sentencing rehabilitation.
Yes, and so I think he actually got the benefit from it. So if there was an error,
it shortened his sentence.
It's in his favor.
I think so, and certainly in sentencing Mr. Minor, the district court emphasized the seriousness of his offense conduct, the fact that he engaged in two bribery schemes, he'd obstructed justice. The court already varied 25 months below his guideline range. It would not have gone further were it not for that stray reference to needing sufficient time in prison to benefit from treatment, in our view. So we'd ask that Minor's sentence be affirmed as well. Unless this court has any more questions for me at this point, I'm happy to rest on the arguments in our brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Diebold.
I'd like to start with the last issue, the Tapia issue. I think the government is confusing the holdings in two different Supreme Court cases. In Pepper, the Supreme Court said that on a resentencing, the court may and in fact should take into account post-sentencing rehabilitation, which is what the judge did when he varied downward for my client. But in Tapia, what the court said, with the government's agreement, is that what a judge can't do is say, I want you to spend time in prison so that you can get into a prison rehabilitation program. In this case, like Tapia, illustrates the reason behind that. Tapia, the defendant in that case, did not get into an alcohol rehabilitation program because it wasn't the judge's decision whether she was going to get rehabilitation in prison. My client also is not in the RDAP program that was at issue in Tapia because the Bureau of Prisons, in its infinite wisdom, has decided that he does not indeed have a sufficiently serious alcohol problem documented by pre-arrest evidence to be in the program, which is why the judge's decision should be sent back for the judge to reconsider whether he would give him the same sentence if he wasn't going to take into account the possibility of rehabilitation in a prison setting as opposed to the supervised release setting, which the judge can control and did dictate in this case.
But what about my read of it that he is acknowledging that Mr. Minor has
made progress,
yes. I guess we'll call it that. It's a lifelong thing, I understand.
The government also took the position in Tapia that a judge can take rehabilitation into consideration in lowering a sentence, but cannot take it into consideration in raising the sentence. And that's.
But I think it's ambiguous here, so how can it be plain error if it's ambiguous what the judge actually did?
We don't believe plain error applies for the very reason that you've articulated. When the judge said, I think you need a sufficient amount of time for rehabilitation, I had no reason to think he was actually tying that to the prison sentence. We had argued, we had agreed that he needed time for rehabilitation once he got out because there's no guarantee he's going to remain alcohol-free. Alcoholics don't get over alcoholism that easily.
Particularly once they lose their law license, et cetera.
I had no reason to think that I should be objecting, especially when the judge hadn't even announced the sentence yet. The government says it should have been so obvious that he was referring to prison that I should have objected, and then they're saying, but we don't think the judge actually changed his prison sentence because of it, which is the only thing that is illegal under Tapia, is if it actually affects the sentence, and there is a sufficient enough reason to believe that it does affect the sentence, that he would be entitled to go back and have that issue retaken up by Judge Wingate. I also need to speak very briefly on the waiver issue. We objected to the lack of in return for language in the original jury instruction request. I commend you to Record Excerpt 8, Instruction Number 18. And in my reply brief at pages 4 to 6, we showed that the argument that was made in this case before the trial judge is that you start with Mississippi law, because Brumley, binding precedent, said that, but you have to have more. And in fact, in your own opinion from 2009, you recognized that that was our position. State law is not enough. Federal law requires something more. We were asking for the same instruction, and just as in the Black case, the Conrad Black case, where the Supreme Court allowed an objection to be argued on remand, even though the precise objection was not the one that led to the reversal in Skilling, this court should at least take up that issue and determine whether or not the instructions were harmless after Skilling. Thank you very much.
Thank you.